There's a man.
But then, this is supposed to be a forum. And there are some of us who take seriously that definition of what's to happen this evening, and so there's going to be a lot less lecturing. In fact, I don't think there's going to be any lecturing at all. We're going to just throw out some of our own ideas and some of our own concepts, and then allow you to discuss them. And John's going to tell you what he hopes to do in the way of changing Holden this evening. Now I hope that he's a little more successful than I was prior to the play the other night, when I was given a cup of water by Terry and proceeded to try to change it. I tried about 12 or 13 in hoc signal vent cases, and that didn't work. I tried two or three simulustus applicators. Hey, you know, is that something?
Yeah.
You know, black man doing that trip again. But then maybe the evening sort of calls for that. That didn't work, and so finally we had to revert to change, mother. While water didn't change, it did something to the imagination of the one who was attempting to change it. So I at least laughed in a drunken manner during the play. John, the question, what can we do as church people, is sort of a proverbial one now. I'm sure that for some of us it's overworked, and we've got clear-cut, definitive answers for it. And then, of course, the next question, which betrays the inherited image of the city. When should we get out of it, or how do we control it once we're out of it? Our questions. One of the real serious ones, I think, has to do with ministry, and whether or not white people can minister in the city, which by definition is the black man's land. Well, none of my red brothers are in here right now, so I think that I can say that without clarifying it and taking too much time doing so. I suppose that following Umhau's devotion is really sort of like attempting to follow Jesus, Jeremiah, Paul, because this betrays, again, a long line of men who are doing something other than proclaiming that God is alive and possibly playing for the New York Mets. I think that it's a hard act to follow, because Umhau sort of gets us into what we want to get into. And it reminds us, I know it reminds me now, of where I came from and how it happens, whether you want it to happen or not. And it's touching and being touched, not overcoming or becoming unaware of color and class distinctions, but recognizing those distinctions and ministering in that situation. Well, that's enough for me now, John. Why don't you go for yourself? I should say that the winds of God interrupted a little act that we were going to put on this evening. So it's been temporarily postponed, and we'll pick it up next week. The winds of God undoubtedly kept Werner either in Chelan or stopped him in the middle of the lake. So he could not bring our stuff here. Next week, maybe I'll find someone else who can do this. Now this is, I guess, the almost totally subjective thing, so far as the city is concerned, and I recognize that, and we want to just leave it for your questioning when John says what he's got to say.
Let me make it clear that I refuse to be a straight man for Will tonight. I'm going to be on my own here. We're going to have an urban-to-urban confrontation in the midst of a wilderness setting, which two black people will not do in the midst of a white setting, so it shows we're both more adventuresome than some other people. There are people, and now many more people than 5 years ago, who can read between the lines and find institutional racism in what they read. There are people, and their number is increasing in the last 2 years, who find male superiority in what they read. And the Women's Lib can pick it up. They can just find it everywhere. We have one layman in the District of Columbia who is very sharp and has as his thing institutional clericalism in that which comes out from church headquarters. And I'm just amazed that because he's sensitive to it, it's really there. They're very hard. About all I really want to do is to tell you that within our church and within Holden and within the songs we sing here, there is an anti-urban kind of institutional anti-urban feeling. I'd like to try to smoke that out so that we can then talk about that for a while. I think it's very important for the sake of the church. We live in an urban country. Whether you're a dairy farmer or whether you live full-time at Holden Village, you're part of an urban culture. That was not true 50 years ago, but the country is now urban. And within a very few years, 75% of our people will actually live in the urban centers. If I'm at all correct historically and sociologically, whereas European people like their cities, we do not like our cities. We almost resent them. And the church is not very helpful in that phenomena. I went to one of our seminaries and was told by the dean of that seminary, if you fellows had really wanted an occupation where you would throughout your life be closer to God than in any other occupation, you would have been farmers. But since you've chosen to be pastors, I hope you'll be good ones. We have thought in terms of the hills and the mountains, a retreat to the quietness of God's nature as a place where it was very easy to be close to God, as a city, a place where it's almost impossible to be close to God. In fact, I think we've thought of it as being held under the domain of Satan. The city is the devil's domain, and God still has the wilderness. So if you want to get close to him, you leave the evil, sinful city, and you come out to where he's waiting for you. That makes it very difficult to talk about ministry in the city if you're assuming that God is not there and you somehow have to bring him there, or that you will have to experience him in spite of all surroundings, all activities, and all environment. In fact, I guess the strongest I can say it is, I think that would make it impossible for you to really minister in the city. The other day, and this is rather caustic, when I was in seminary, they said either get a wife or a tape recorder so that you can sort of keep track of yourself and what you say, and I took them seriously and got both. I don't have my tape recorder here, but my wife always informs me when I'm too caustic. That's, I guess, a thing that I do. I said the other day that Washington, D.C. has two kinds of churches, suburban churches located in the suburbs and suburban churches located in the city. I meant by that I'm not sure that we really have a congregation who feels that they can celebrate the city, that they are comfortable downtown. First of all, we don't have many churches where their members even live within the District of Columbia. Lutheran population in the District of Columbia is 0.7% out of 800,000 people. Now, we'll raise some questions about the church in the city. We inevitably will get into what form will that take. I hope it will surprise you. It sometimes surprises filling station attendants as we drive across the country and they go to write down the license plate and see District of Columbia and then stare at me and my wife and our four children just sort of aghast and look again to see and realize we are not black. Many people say, do you actually live in the District of Columbia? Sort of assume, since I'm white and maybe middle class, that I would naturally live in the suburbs. I'm very willing, and I'll be glad to bring my wife into it, very willing to talk about what it's like to live in the city. I have a couple sons and I guess a couple daughters here in public education, whereas the District of Columbia is 63% black, the school system is 94% black, so there are not many white people who do take the option of public education. So that if we talk city, if we talk church in the city, if we talk black, white, Lutheranism in the city, style of life, what it means to celebrate that, are we really anti-urban, what will that mean for the next decade? Those are the things that we wanted to talk about, and we have both felt that there maybe has been a minimum of time for really having a forum. And therefore, we didn't want to make it a lecture. We want to open it up. If you want to open it up now or respond to that, fine. But really, it's your hour.
Well, John, let's start with one question, which how many black people live in your neighborhood? How many white people live in your neighborhood? Let's start with those.
All right. When people ask me, do you have an inner city congregation, and I answer yes, and they never ask anything else, I assume that they go away figuring I'm in the middle of a black ghetto, which is not true. One of the stereotypes I hope that we knock down tonight is I live in a fairly affluent square mile. It is in the center of Washington, D.C., 10 blocks from the White House. The square mile has 40,000 people in it. There are 85 high-rise apartments already, and their number is increasing. These are the ones with an elevator and at least 10 floors. There are many apartments, but 85 of those which I call high-rise. The District of Columbia, you can't build anything above some part of the Capitol, so 90 feet is the limit. There is included in that square mile Watergate East. Watergate East is bigger than just John Mitchell's apartment, but it's more famous since he moved in there. The penthouse of Watergate East is $290,000. Now, you don't really buy it for that. You own it, but it's at the top of the building. It's only a three-bedroom penthouse. That's probably the most expensive apartment in D.C. George Washington University has 11,000 students, and they're within the square mile. Most of them do not live in dormitories, but they come there to school. We have the largest rooming house in our area and maybe in the country. It has 850 people when it's filled, and they take 62 separate buildings to house them. That gives you a young adult mobile population. We have, out of the last census, 258 single-family occupied units. That'll give you some idea of the stability of our neighborhood. We just don't have it. Rooming house, former Victorian row house, now having 20 adults in it. You have bilingual talk at almost all of our stores because of the Spanish people. So you have a microcosm of the whole city, and I would judge that 70% of that square mile is white.
Okay. Going back to what you said, you detect an anti-urban sentiment, and I would have to agree. Definitely, I'm anti-urban. Small town, or I'm a small city, or large town is my choice. But I think it's more than just an anti-something. You say, this idea of being able to be closer to God out in the country is against the city. I think there's something more there, too. You're able to get closer to yourself out wilderness area, where the comforts, the conveniences, etc., of civilization are not nearly so easy to come by, so that you're reduced to a little bit more of what you really are yourself. When we take boys out and scouting out to Philmont, or up in the Canoe area of Minnesota or something like that, or these outward bound schools. They're not held in the middle of a city. They're out where you have to rely only on yourself. So you get a lot closer to yourself as well as to God. I think that has to be recognized, so that I don't think that's entirely an unjustifiable feeling.
Joe,
I'm defending myself, of course.
I want to ask Joe a question. Do you have a lift in the city?
You mean Ray?
You mean me?
Joe.
Ray?
Ray.
Me?
Have you ever lived in a city?
No, I have never lived in one. I've visited in.
But you've never lived in one. I don't think you'd say that if you have, because I was raised in a big city and I now live in suburbia. And I can tell you, you can be much more alone by yourself and anonymous in a city than you ever can. I assume from what I've read in fiction in small towns, but certainly in suburbia where everybody is.
No, you're taking this in a slightly different context. I mean, different meaning from what I mean. I'm taking away the convenience of civilization, not necessarily just people.
Let me add something just to that. As long as you spoke to it, that I have been living here at Holden for a year. My time away to find myself is going into Seattle or Portland, back into those things. I mean, I think there's something to be said for that type of an experience, of a retreat experience. Not the description of the location, but the fact of change, going back into it.
Leo, and then you're going to watch him.
Yeah, I love the city. I've lived in the city. And the thing about the city is, that's where you find people, and people is what it's all about. And where is there a greater opportunity to meet and enjoy people, and even though you don't have to talk to them or communicate with them, which I like to do, they're around you all the time, and you feel the power of people. And that can only happen in the city. Not like in the city. I've lived in the inner city, and one summer I spent, and it was the happiest summer of my life.
Okay.
You know, all the good things that Ray was saying about becoming self-reliant and sort of stripping yourselves of the props, I can think of that could happen in the city too. And he was talking about being stripped of the comforts of civilization. I can visualize in the city in which I grew up, Chicago, places in the heart of the city that are stripped of every good definition of civilization. That, for instance, you know, as Howard Long would talk about a culture, maybe you have running water, but maybe that's all you've got in the way of a real community. So you could be in the wilderness, you could be in the wasteland, only it's just another way of doing it.
I think you got a practical problem, that even if you were to agree that living away from the city was a better lifestyle, and maybe the Amish people had the ultimate in this country as far as that goes, but there just isn't enough fertile land or enough area so that you can take the city population and spread them around through the rural countryside and expect them, number one, to make a living, number two, there'll be enough room. And I would hope that even if we would agree that that was a desirable lifestyle, that the middle class white Christian don't go there. I think there's a need for them in the city. Will, would you respond to that?
Yeah. See, the whole problem has to do, I think, with, like I said, one, an inherited image of the city and the seeming paranoia about it. I got two definitions running through my mind now. One is the definition of a small town. That definition is sort of stereotyped. Definition of a small town is where everybody knows everybody's business and they read the newspapers to see who got caught in it. Definition of city, I suppose, is also the stereotype, and I talked to John about it, and it started way, way back in the old days when the boys went away to war, and there was a rather interesting question which hasn't been answered yet: how are you going to get them back on the farm once they've seen Paris? You know.
You mean the mama who worries?
Yes.
When her daughter's boyfriend, the country mama, when her daughter's boyfriend takes her to the city, and the city mama worries when her daughter's boyfriend takes her out in the country.
Sort of jumps the gun on us, I guess, John, and proves that one depends on the other. More ways than one. But the question of what's needed in the city in terms of people, I think is a good one. Yes, middle-class white Christians are needed in the city. And I suppose that you have to understand properly that middle-class white Christians need the city. Well, I was telling somebody earlier, maybe around this fire, about the man who made enough money to get out of it and moved way, way down the peninsula, somewhere between San Francisco and San Jose. And he's got a Mark IV and he's comfortable, green grass, birds singing, etc. He's got a scowl on his face as he gets out of his house and gets in his car and drives down the access road to the entrance ramp for the freeway, and there in big white letters on the green sign it says Cultural Center 25 miles. And the caption under the picture, of course, is a question: who's culturally deprived? You see. This I think answers your question in a different kind of way. Right. From the city still flows life for everything around it. And everything around it depends on it. Somebody was saying that a few well-placed arsenic bottles, you know, at the farmer's market could literally destroy half the life around it. Not the people in the city, but those outside of the city. Everything comes through it. And the problem, at least as we see it, is that people don't recognize interdependence and they exercise a sort of zookeeper mentality. Because there is the inherited image of being caged there, you know, and being trapped. And it's sort of in the cage and out of the cage without really realizing that that's what you've done.
Well, excuse me, as I hear this dialogue, I'm hearing two things. One, I'm hearing color being made an issue in this, black and white middle class. We need more white middle class in the city. And I'm also hearing a distinction made between the farm community and the city community, and definitely there is a distinction. But I'm wondering if the real problem that we're facing is not a color problem, nor is it a farmer versus city dweller problem, but it's a problem of the heart and how we see that other individual, our relationship to Jesus Christ, and our relationship to mankind, as it were. When I look at you, I don't see color. I see a human being. I see a child of God. And as I look at someone who dwells in the larger city, I don't see a city dweller. I see a human being whose blood is running through his veins the same as mine runs through mine, and I see a child of God, one who is created by God, and one who is dependent upon me just the same as I am dependent upon him. So the issue that we're facing is not one of distinction, but one of we ourselves in our particular heart, in our relationship to God.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, Paul.
Which one's Will? I can't tell. With being anti-city, I think our cities stink. There, I can think of only one city in the country that I feel is fit for human habitation. And I don't think it's an objection to the people there. I'm not hung up on rural life. I don't think it's a paranoia or anything. I just find that our cities aren't fit for human habitation. I think John, you mentioned that people, didn't you? People in Europe love their cities. Americans don't. No wonder European cities are fit for human habitation.
Oh.
Some of them.
You've been to Venice?
Some of them.
The city with the open air sewer system?
Well, that can be improved. But before we start celebrating the city, I'd like to change the city.
In what ways? In what ways do I change?
Well, we're sort of hung with the problem here of how you swat a fly. if he's in a jug. You've got one of two choices, haven't you, Paul? You either get into the jug with him, which increases your chances of swatting him, or you let him out into the ionosphere and kill yourself trying to catch up with him. You know.
Well, I live in the city, and I'd like to change that city. I'm not going to celebrate it. I think there are all kinds of things about that city that are terrible. I criticize it all the time.
What things that you would think you would like to see changed?
Well,
I don't see how you can change Dallas. It hasn't been built yet.
Well, basically, it's the thing I was harping on last night. I won't harp on it again. I'll just mention it. And our cities have been built for the care, housing, and movement of automobiles, not people. And that's a fundamental problem. They are. Sure, there are a lot of great human things that go on there. A surprising amount of really human things that go on in the city go on in highly congested neighborhoods, what we call blighted neighborhoods, slum areas, where people are stacked up on top of each other. Now that's a disadvantage. Nobody wants to be stacked on top of other people. But when you live in a congested, a real congested neighborhood, there's community very often. You can walk around and people are sitting on the front stoop and you can wave and say hello. And most cities, that's not possible. It seems to me the city is an inhuman place. Cars can be happier, people can't. And the suburbs are just as bad. The suburbs are just an extension of the city.
You want to speak to that?
We got at least three things that have come at us, none of which, you know, if we start on this, we're leaving a couple others. I don't really mind one or the other, but we either ought to stick on one and answer it, or just continue to let people bat around ideas or suggestions. Let's hold that for just a minute. I once heard a man who had just talked about the church's responsibility in the city, which is also what we're on a little bit. I hope it's more than where's the most pleasant place for me. I'm not sure, Paul, that you mean you're going to choose the place most pleasant for you. There was once a Presbytery meeting where a man wanted them to fund a ministry in the city. And another man stood up and said, not only do I think we should not fund you, I think we ought to have you committed for taking your wife and your family and yourself into that particular neighborhood. I think that you have proved that you're really not sane. And the answer was, well, you tell me where there's a safer place for me than in the middle of God's will for my life. And the other man sat down and the Presbytery funded the project. So I hope we're talking more than just where is it most pleasant for me to live? That would be one thing. Now, the matter of the heart. A sincere Christian heard this responsibility of the church in the city and said, I live in the suburbs. What can I do? I'm interested in the people of the city. How can I help the problem? And the speaker far outdid me in caustic comments and said, "Excuse me, sir, I've had that response so often that I'm just tired of it. Don't you know yet you are the problem? When you drove through and chose to drive through that invisible tax wall that surrounds the center of this urban area and live in the suburbs and get all the benefits and want to drive downtown for the good restaurants and the theater at night, but do not want to bear the tax responsibility for the welfare, housing, sewage, and everything else of the center of your metropolitan area, you are the problem. Now don't tell me you want to come down and tutor our children." I think it was a good answer. I'm not sure that it increased dialogue because the man who gave it was angry. And he even admitted that he was just so tired of the question that he undoubtedly was going to be too angry when he answered. I think, and this, that was another man's answer, and that was another man's question, but it's sort of prelude that I'm a little bit tired of hearing that it's a matter of the heart. That doesn't really help my neighbors. That doesn't really do much about their condition. I gave a talk about what was needed in D.C., and I talked about a lot of kids who were being helped at a place called the Runaway House, and I feel it's a fine ministry. And someone in the audience said, "Do they testify to Jesus Christ in that house, and do you make sure that all the counselors are believers?" And I said, "We advertised for a long time and we didn't get any of your believers. We've got some kids who apparently do not acknowledge Jesus Christ, but for $10 a week, they're ministering to some other people. When you and your believers come in, I'll be glad to have you. You haven't showed up yet." Sometimes you get a little tired. Now, for the kinder remark, we'll turn to Will because he's much more gentle.
Which one of us said this? Which one of us said what you just said? Maybe Paul's seeing right. No, I think that the question which expects the invitation to the Lady Bountifuls who descend on the city with secondhand cans of anchovies and old clothes is where we at. And the white noose around the thing that we don't like is the thing that we're trying to address ourselves to. It is a color problem. When the children of the devil moved in, the children of the angels fled. And that's why you've got huge buildings with German and Norwegian inscriptions on the cornerstone yet that have either been sold to the Baptists or converted into car wash places, or removed and replaced with high-rise buildings, or removed and the lots left vacant. Now that is not true in Washington as much as it's true in Rochester, New York, and Buffalo, New York, and New York City, and Chicago, and hundreds of other cities all over these United States. So it is a matter of color. Well, I suppose that if we want to chase the matter of the heart to its logical conclusion, it's a matter of the heart being sort of duped by a rather perverted and fouled up color scheme. Now, I think that the thing that I want to raise is whether or not we accept the basic premise of our interdependence on each other, or whether or not we accept the definition that the city is not sacrosanct, at least in its relationships to communities around it, nor are the communities around it sacrosanct, but one community. That's what we mean when we talk about metropolitan ministry as opposed to inner city ministry or a specific urban ministerial task. We generally talk about the metropolitan area. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Kahn's book, The Year 2000. No, nobody. I think I saw Paul's hand. Paul, what would your response be to Herman Kahn's reading of strip cities?
You never have the courage to disagree with him.
He raises a rather interesting thing. First of all, he takes one community and he calls it Chippets. Chippets. That's the name of the new town. One continuous city from Chicago to Pittsburgh. And there's another one called Boswash. One continuous city from Boston to Washington. Nothing in between except city. And there's another one called San San. All the way from Seattle, if it stays here, to San Diego. San Francisco to San Diego.
Frightening. Well, let's either get in on what we just did or move to whether or not they're really so bad that it's unrealistic to talk about celebrating. Mary?
I'd like to respond to your caustic remark.
Which one?
Well, this guy that asked that question, you know, I live in a suburb, what can I do? And the guy got mad. He spun it off. I can see why he got mad, because he's been asked that question a lot of times. And I'd like to ask that question. Because you're there, John.
Yeah.
And I'm not. And you and I talked one time, I don't know if you remember, 10 or 12 years ago, and we ruled together up there in Chicago, and I asked you some pretty dumb questions, I guess, as far as you were concerned, but things are beginning to open up in this area for me, and this guy, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, he wanted to know. Now, what would you do in your little square mile in Washington, D.C., if all of a sudden a bunch of Christians descended on you and said, here we are, John, you know, and we're going to live here, not because we feel thrust into it, not because we'll be forced into it, but because we want to be here. Now, that's ridiculous. It won't happen. But here's a guy, maybe that was sincere and wanted to know. Is it going to be one by one, or does it have to be, you know, the whole church descending on the situation?
All right. You've given one possibility. If I were answering that man and assumed that it was a legitimate question, which I think it was, if you want to move into the city, okay, let's talk about that. He didn't. He didn't say he wanted to. All right, he's going to live in the suburbs. I would give two things right now in suburban Washington, D.C. that I would list highest on his priority. One is to work for a metropolitan tax base so that his taxes helped the entire metropolitan area's welfare, housing, and all the other problems. I'd work for a metropolitan tax base, and I'd work for full open occupancy in his neighborhood. I'd ask him to take the pressure off of slum properties and what people have to pay in rent. $110 a week for two rooms and share the bath with 12 adults. $110 a month for two rooms. The only reason is there is a line, and you cannot say black people can move out into Northern Virginia or Silver Spring easily. They simply can't. I'd do two things. Work for a metropolitan tax base and open occupancy housing out where he lived. I'd start there.
That's somebody, a good place to start, seems
yeah.
to me.
Well, you know, and of course, then comes the difficult one. Should I sell my house to a black person? I say no. Buy the house next to you and sell that one to a black person.
Hi, you know, Justin, in relation to your being caustic, I guess I'm feeling a little caustic at the moment, too, in relation to this heart thing that came from across the field, and that's really nice.
But lo and behold, it was discovered after just an awful lot of hard, hard legal work in tracing through a bunch of legal gobbledygook who the owner of an awful lot of slum land, you know, slum housing in Los Angeles is, and Miami, and it's none other than, you know, Pat Boone. That's me. Pat Boone, who is now, by the way, dumped all of the Hollywood jazz in order that he can be involved in somehow, I'm not sure how, in the filming in that, of the Crossing the Switchblade. That's groovy. But it took all kinds of legal gobbledygook to get down to find out that it was indeed Pat Boone through all kinds of corporations that he had formed, and those were the names, and when you get through all that crap, it's Pat Boone.
But for a minute, you're going to say the church owned it.
Well, he's got a church going for him. It was called Up With People. I don't know what it's called now. Huh? Something like that, yeah. But he's a terrific, very fine, all-American, white-shoed Christian boy.
Watch it.
I wears white socks.
Right. Paul, come up out of the darkness.
There. John, could I ask a question? I think one reason we've been rambling a little, at least to me, I'm not just sure what the question is. I'm not sure what the conflict is. It hasn't, for me, been pinpointed.
I have a basic premise that if the church is called to be a ministering body of Christ, if the church's commission in this age is to be faithful to her Lord in the midst of that which is the growing edge of life in the United States, if the church finds, meets, and joins with her Lord in the place where he promises to be among oppressed people in a ministry of reconciliation and healing, and you know, I could go on, and I've done that more in the morning, so I won't have to repeat it now. It seems to me that in order to do that, we have to face the challenge of the ministry in the city. A big handicap to that is not expertise, but a hang-up we have about the city, some misconceptions about the city, and the feeling that that instead of joining him in his ministry there, we go into a very alien, God-forsaken, well, when I say mission field, all the world's a mission field, but instead of the abandonment that the gospel brings, where you really go in with a song and go in some way celebrating life in the midst of any kind of circumstances, even if Paul Hayne is right, if Paul Hayne is right, Christians out of all the people in the world should be able to dwell in tents, unaware or at least able to overcome outward circumstances and live some kind of celebration in the midst of that which everybody else calls misery. And instead of that, we've given exactly the opposite impression, and we have run from the city. Detroit, I think 40 Lutheran churches in the last 10 years have moved out of the city and have taken the buildings where their people already are in the suburbs. Time after time, we leave a neighborhood. And I just think that if you're going to talk about the mission of the church in the next 20 years, we have to face sort of honestly how we feel so that we can begin to be faithful to that which I think is God's call upon his church. So we took one segment of that, and that is really, how do you feel about the city? You know, we've taken a slice of the whole matter of the mission of the church, and we've taken out of that slice sort of our urban attitudes. Does that help?
Yeah. The only thing I don't understand, though, first you tell the story of the man who would not answer the man because he wasn't willing to move out of the suburb into the city.
Yeah.
Then you give the suburban the advice to make things possible for people to move out of the city where he is.
Yeah. Well, okay. All right. Perhaps it will be a humanizing thing for the city not to be inner city suburb, but to be a metropolitan area. If that's a humanizing thing for everybody involved, I'm all for it. I'm not masochist enough to help create a situation bad enough that the Christians can give a good example of how to live in misery. I mean, that's really a rather strange kind of sequence of events. I am interested in the living conditions being better for everybody. I don't think the gospel is limited if the conditions are bad. I don't think the gospel wants the conditions so bad that it can prove itself in the midst of misery. I do not think that the gospel necessarily will have done its work, and certainly not its complete work, when people have better housing. The gospel goes much farther than that. That does not mean that the Christian is not interested in housing. If in a metropolitan area there were not racial boundaries, if in a metropolitan area there was nothing called a ghetto, I think it would be easier then for all people to celebrate the city, and I think that's one of the things we work for. And the church should find the ways in which it does that, so that we're into things that sound secular, we're into things that sound political, and I just can't make those distinctions about that's clearly the mission of the church, this isn't the mission of the church. I think that's part of our problem, those kind of separations, and saying that's someone else's domain.
John, I'm hearing now some caustic remarks coming out in this, and I'm hearing the church's responsibility, and frankly, it isn't the church's responsibility, it's your responsibility, it's my responsibility, it's the responsibility of every individual. It isn't some bureaucratic body. What are we talking about when we're using the term church? Whose responsibility is this to find out what the problem is and try to deal with the problem? Am I, who happen to live in a small city, am I to move out of my particular location to go and add more congestion to the city to try to correct the situation there? This is what I'm asking, and this is why I'm asking. It is a matter of heart now, and how I take my responsibility to my fellow man, and how I view it in how Christ causes me to think in this relationship. And so I ask a question because I don't know how all of these conditions exist, and I don't care how many times a question has been asked. We may get tired of it, but by the same token, it's a valid question, and we never know how many people are going to be asking this question until that right person asks, and if he's met with a caustic comment or remark of somebody who's fed up with this thing, how is he going to react to that? Now, he may have reacted if he's treated with some kind of Christian love.
May I ask
you? Go ahead. Do you have a specific question? I'm not condoning the answer to. I've too much time on this one dialogue already. I'm not condoning the answer. I tried to give an answer when Vern Moore did ask the question. I tried to give an answer as to the two things I would recommend first. All right. In answer to your question, if it's specifically, should I move into the city and leave my small town? Probably not. I'm not saying that that's necessary. My answer might be, find your ministry in your small town, like this suburban man had his primary ministry where he lived. Okay. Now, and I'm not saying it isn't ultimately a matter of the heart. I'm just saying that I think in order to make that, to make that answer valid, and the answer is valid, to make it valid, you have to talk about some concrete, specific activities that indicate that there is the heart for the kind of servanthood that Christ calls us for. So I don't know if we're disagreeing or if we have a specific question.
Well, this is what I'm saying. If we are spending more time looking at Christ and how his handling of certain circumstances were in his relationship to mankind, and if we accept as being Christian our responsibility, and if we accept the empowerment of
of God by the power of the Holy Spirit to walk according to how He directs us, then we're not walking with our eyes on ourselves or our eyes on other mankind. We're walking with our eyes on the Lord. He is our guide, and He will lead us to whatever particular responsibility that He has for us. Now, I think in turn, the cross and the switchblade was mentioned. Now, I don't know a great deal about Pat Boone or all of this type of thing, and but the issue here is, here was a man, David Wilkerson, a pastor who went into the inner city, as it were, as nearly as I understand the story, and he created a mission, and he built a church, and dollars came into this, and he didn't know where they were going to come from, but he was leaning on the power of God, the power of the Holy Spirit, if you will, to be his guide, and he went where he felt he was directed.
There's another reality that, like in L.A., he came into L.A., and there was only one person in the community he went into that he was able to influence. And the reason was, he said very definitely, he seen there was no possibility that he could have a long beard and be a Christian. And so he had to leave that community and turn it over to somebody else in the beach. And it wasn't until very recently that he began to see that maybe that wasn't Christian at all, and that he really had something all fouled up.
All right, which is an indication that man frequently, no matter who that man is, gets in the way of God's plan, and he is focusing on himself and not focusing on the Lord and his what God directs him to do, and we're all guilty of it.
Part yeah, of that's it, you know, is his focusing so much on God that he couldn't see at all God in the city or God in man. You know, he was kind of looking up in the clouds, waiting for something to come.
You can't knock his ministry in New York.
What?
You can't knock his ministry in New York.
Well,
I mean,
close,
that was a second.
Well, but I was close to
it. Okay, we're looking at the man, though. We're looking at the man. We're not looking at the Lord. I mean, what happened in New York?
Yeah, but I was right next to his ministry in New York.
Yeah.
You know?
Was it poor?
He was changing, you know. This is what I saw the
Lord. Well, this happens. People lose their consecration, I think.
Well, I saw him growing. You know, I saw him growing as a, you know, in spite of who he was, God was using him. That's the way to
well, that's the way with all of us.
Yeah, well, that's
this is certainly true in my own case. I mean, for a bumbling, dumb, white-socked kid whose parents were immigrants, and to get accepted into college was something that was incredible. And I know what these kids go through in the ghettos, because my dad talked about this thing. He came out of the European caste system, and he thought his kids should be nothing but farmers, because there were people that were professional people, there were people that ran things, there were politicians, and there were people that worked. And he worked with his back, he worked in the mines, he worked in the logging camps, and he worked on the waterfront. And his biggest goal for me was to get any kind of a job that I could. So my first job was sweeping floors and cleaning out urinals. And when I finally got to be a journeyman sheet metal worker, he thought I had arrived. Now I know that things, barriers come up. I never realized that there was any chance at all of me ever making it in college. I was beat before I ever started. So I think the key issue with the ghettos gets down to the kids getting some personal feeling of acceptability, some personal...
Okay, now we're talking about exposure. That's different for
right.
you, though. That's a different thing.
Right.
You're talking about exposure. Part of my flash, I guess, coming to you is the thing that, you know, of asking a suburban community, you know, we, you know, need some people in terms of helping with some kind of program in the city, in terms of recreation or as Bible study, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And as a kind of a very minor thing. And their answer coming back, we'll pray for you and we'll, and this kind of thing. We don't feel we can ask anybody to help you, or we can't send any money, you know. And this coming back, continually being fed back, you know, at least in Los Angeles area, And so you know, I'm partly reacting to that is, you're sure we're talking about the faith thing, but when I look at it, I see, where is it, you know? It's not
coming. There are some sweet people in Los Angeles.
What?
There are some sweet people in Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but in terms of, you know, so much of the negative is coming. So,
well, that's what I'm getting here. The Lord is very positive, and His direction is very positive. And if we're active with our love, extending ourselves, maybe I just drive through.
Okay, those are words, but I'm kind of, you know, say, you know, where's that happening other than in words? And I heard you talking a little bit about exposure, which I like, because that means you're getting involved and vulnerable and you're there. See, that's good. You know, I mean, I can identify with that. You know, I can't identify with saying, I'm going to do something there, or what can I do? You know, I get a little costly, I guess, because I hear that so much too. And I have to look inside of me and say, I've got to get in a critical spirit, because I've heard so much about love and seen so little of it from the terms of the Christian kind of thing.
There's a thought that comes to me here as we talk about this thing. I hear so much about love and see so little of it. And I have, in my own experiences now, I find that at those times that I'm seeing very little love, it's because I'm loving very little. Because I'm loving very little. And at any time that I am showing love to someone else, I'm feeling love in return.
There's only one thing you can do with love, and that's give it. Amen. Nobody can keep a ledger card, and anybody that tries to is way out.
You call Paul forth out of the darkness. What was your point?
Is he still there?
Yeah, he's still there.
Well, I think I'm not saying that we're off the subject for tonight, because I think everything is on the subject. I think his question is very close to the heart of my understanding for the evening. And if he's right about the cities just can't be celebrated, I think that's, you have to face
that.
He's not. Is that the better half?
I just wanted to offer them an optional.
No, John, look, the city can be celebrated. There's much in the city that can be celebrated, even though. But, and a lot more in San Francisco. but I want to be sure that when Christian isn't some of it, just go into the city and celebrate it. There are lots of things in the city that need to be changed. And I think that the black-white question is a problem that grossly aggravates the situation. But I think that if racism and all of its historical residues were to disappear completely tomorrow, we would still have an urban problem. The way our cities are laid out and arranged, all of the institutions and habits that have grown up around city life, just make most of our cities and most of their parks inhuman places. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go in there and celebrate the good that's there, but I want to be sure that we change some things, too.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess there's a different concept to celebrate, maybe. Mary?
Books for the children, so that teachers take it out of their mind. I know
as much as I would like to say I'm very interested in this problem and I really would like to help, I would not have helped unless our children had been subjected to this day after day and put next to the clinic because there was no room in the school cafeteria. I would not have gone down and started the library in public school or any of the things that we tried to do. And unless you're there, and again, not it's going to go there, but I think the people that have moved into the district, the whites, the middle class whites, who have had money for tax, I mean, they're a power base as far as their tax money. They have the know-how, they have the connections, they know how to lobby for pressure to write and stop Congress from putting an international center in our area. They would have cleared out all of the blacks and simply made it a stone international center with all the embassies and the chancellors right together. The bus fare raise that we worked on now, or anything else, it really takes some interested people who are willing to get together. And that's maybe why I think the community of Christ has some validity, because we need each other so desperately in the city, and therefore we feel a closeness, and we have a, we want to show, you know, that Christ is something very special to us, and we need to support one another, not only physical support, but their prayer support, and I think that's what makes worship so good. But I think you can't all just say, you know, the city's got to change unless you get in there and really get sweat and tears and everything else by some people that will go in and do it. And there are a lot of people like that who just want to do it, want to see a change, not just us in a community crisis, it's a drop in an emotion. But I think that's the start.
You know, the fascinating thing about San Francisco is that, apart from Paul's admiration of it, of course, is that very few people either get out to Hunter's Point, where thousands of people are living in World War II shacks, with a view of the city and a view of the ocean, of course, but World War II shacks. And they very seldom, if ever, get into the Fillmore District. Now, they do get into Chinatown, and I suppose there's some, because the Grey Line tours go through there, and there's something interesting about looking at the funny people and the funny signs, and it's sort of this zookeeper mentality, come home, not to roost, but to pass through and view the thing. Recently, we had a big fight, and then had the fight solved by a rather intelligent and very Christian suburbanite who sort of frustrated the bag which the satellite communities around San Francisco and Oakland had. The bag was the Association of Bay Area Governments, ABAG it was called, for short. And this fellow saw what was happening and walked off with all of the money. And destroyed the organization. The organization, in spite of the rhetoric which said we are organizing here to keep our city the way it is, etc., etc., we're really organizing to live off of the thing they hated most and to ensure that this life was not threatened by home rule again, and San Francisco is no different from Washington in that respect. It is controlled and run by people who live outside of it. For example, at least 85% of the policemen in San Francisco live outside of the city, and they agonize on the freeway just like everybody else does to come in to do an 8-hour job, and then they go back to their bedroom communities. So it seems to me that the one thing that is needed at this point is some sort of coalition which makes it unprofitable for people to do that. Now, the tax thing is one thing, but there are, you know, some other suggestions which I think can come from out there too, you know, when one's own vested interest is seriously threatened by the rather rapid pace of urban renewal in our cities. What I mean is lighted matches and things like this.
Well, I think that it's interesting, as I reflect back on the way that that I was raised and taught, that I was taught to hate the city. And I think this is awfully true of an awful lot of us that were raised in suburbia. The strange part of it is, I think that it continues, that we move to the point where we also teach our children to hate the city. And I hear a lot of talk of caring about people in the city, but frankly, I don't really think that we give a damn about the people in the city. That's their own trip that they're on, and if they want to live in the city, that's their own thing. And as Christians, I think we have to pay lip service to it, because that eases us. But I really think when it comes right down to it that we really don't even care. Which, you know, and this really disturbs me, because I think that we're moving much more, you know, I think that we are all urban beings anyway, because of the television, etc. And that we aren't even accepting it. We're still fighting it with this agrarian mentality. The agrarian myth, which I think that's exactly what it is a myth. And we haven't really began to face it yet. And face it head on. I don't know.
Paul?
Yeah. There's a magazine that comes out four times a year that I highly recommend. It's called The Public Interest. Very few people subscribe to it, but I think it's one of the best things currently being published. It brings some of the results of solid research in the social sciences down to a level where it can be understood, digested, and talked about by people who are not specialists in the disciplines. Anyhow, then the last year, they had a special issue devoted exclusively to New York City. And that was a real mind-blower for me. Because I assumed, you know, I was pretty wise to what was going on in the city and the dynamics of the city, what causes cities to change in the directions in which they do change, how their politics are run, the economics of the city, and all that. And I guess there must have been 122 myths that I had entertained that were exploded by that issue of public interest. And I feel now that one of the reasons why we talk so much about the city and succeed in doing so very little to initiate changes, to overcome the problems that we're worried about, is that we really know very little about it. Now, I'm not talking just about myths derived from a rural background. Just all kinds of just plainly wrong notions, for example, about the role of corruption in the city. You know, we all know cities are corrupt. The one thing we don't know is the positive functions of corruption. We're going to have to learn something. That's a hard doctrine.
Will,
yeah. Just to follow that up, I've been thinking, glad nobody else is here from Fairmont because they call me a traitor. But I really think that even in our very, very conservative, upper middle class, white, Republican community there, we have a fair proportion of the same type of problems. I mean, in proportion, maybe not exactly, but to our number of people. But there are not enough of them that we really have to, you know, we can hide them, sweep them under the rug. And I was kind of thinking, I wonder if that might not be the definition of the difference between a small town and a city. When the problems get big enough, you can't ignore them. Because I know from working in the schools of families that we have no difference of different races, we're all white, but there in a small way, we've got an inner circle that's very different from the, you know, this is a community of only 10,000, but it's just sort of more or less ignored, nobody really wants to admit it.
Well, don't people who live in those cities have to do it for themselves? I mean, people can't come in from an outlying community and just go in and say, now we're going to change your life. Don't they have to do this for themselves?
Yeah,
don't they have to have the motivation to do something for themselves?
John. I'd like to recall your first premise because it's kind of on that line about the urbanized taxis. I disagree with that very much. My thoughts go more along the line of what Norman Mailer campaigned in his 1969 race for mayor in New York City, where you break up the autonomy of government in the city into neighborhood districts, where, you know, in areas where it is possible. And, you know, thus you don't have the alienation, you know, from your own government, from the people who control you. And this will get people more involved with you, you know, in making their own decisions for their own destination. And, also he campaigned on making New York City a 51st state. And I think that was a brilliant idea, too.
You will fight. Well, I see some advantages to participatory democracy, but I'm not sure that I would feel that smaller autonomous communities within a metropolitan area for the sake of a feeling of neighborliness when you have a whole accumulation of history that has left them with most of the problems and the least of the tax base works out economically to be feasible, even though they have the vote to who governs them. I don't know. You'd have to. You think? Well, of course. Go ahead.
But what I was going to say, maybe in the short run, that these people would progress less, but in the long run, they would progress more.
I don't know. Yeah.
I really think that way. I think they'd be much, much better off.
In regard to schools, which I'm concerned with, this is one of the big problems is education. And how can you provide adequate schools in a poor district? It just, the money just ain't there. It's got to come from someplace else. This is why we have these state equalization, state support to equalize. But that, where you have such a great disparity between these between the suburbs and between the ghetto. In many cases, the equalization just doesn't do it. It just doesn't do it. Yeah, that situation in Minnesota. They just don't come out anywhere.
Another one of the myths that I don't know whether it was dealt with in the article that Paul read or not, is this ghetto myth. Communities that we're in are called ghettos. I remember just before we moved out there, Newsweek did an article on Oakland, and the conclusion was that Oakland had a year of grace before it would be in some rather serious trouble from blacks who would elect to give vent to their frustrations by burning it up. And the article was about the ghetto. Now, prior to my moving to the city from a small University of Alabama town, University of Alabama, I sort of accepted that definition until I got in. And I think that the myth of ghetto explodes in front of your eyes when you see community. And probably one of the best visible topographies of community anywhere in the United States today. Certainly when it's held under the glaring white-hot ray of our definition of community and contrasted with what would be defined as an ideal community, the balances suddenly shift to the city where you find community. For example, in our town we have two cities. We have the city that's operating in the daytime, and we have the city that's operating at night. They are called night people. And they stay inside all day long while the other folks are working at it. And after 8 o'clock, they come out. It is a real trip to have a ministry that goes from 8 o'clock at night until 9 o'clock the next morning. That is where you find community. You see it, and you taste it, and you smell it. It talks to you, it laughs with you, it embraces you. It's a strange sort of thing. You know, I've got some fascinating stories. You know, all of these creepy thoughts about dark alleys and things like this, you know, they just ain't so if you're not there to exploit, but to participate.
We're almost at 10:30. Let me simply say again, and I think I said it only in response to a question that asked me or us to clarify. I still feel, and perhaps more strongly than 5 years ago when we first moved in, that there is a distinct, unique, sort of exciting role for the church in the midst of the city, no matter how long we talk about it, and no matter how complex, and no matter what kinds of feelings you have about it. And I think that it does depend upon a sense of Christian community there. We have a circle called DuPont Circle, and I think it's within the realm of proclamation that with some music and with some banners on Easter Sunday afternoon, we were in the midst of that, which is the hub of activity. I think that's proclamation. I think that it is part of the life of the church in the city to have a cleanup festival with all of the people, of all kinds of people, all ages of people sweeping the streets and having a hot dog barbecue in the midst of a little thing called a park at the end of it. And I guess one of the things that I'm trying to say is that until Christian people feel that they can be fully part of that and find, and we have not really talked much about the advantages of the city. I don't have any grass to mow. We can walk to six theaters and to the Kennedy Center when it's finished and to Constitution Hall and to the White House. The restaurant, never have to drive the car to get to all kinds of things, never have to get in the car to get a quart of milk or any of the other things. The kids have a free swimming pool within 3 blocks and a couple parks, can get to the zoo. We could talk about some of the things that no one yet has mentioned. I did a free association one night in one of the introductory courses to the Community of Christ, free association on city. And all of them were negative terms. I think if we'd have done that tonight, I had sirens and rats and dirt and noise and broken glass and muggings. And these were people who were interested in the Community of Christ, and most of them lived in the city. You know, the kind of anti-urban feelings came out. What I'd like to say is it seems to me that in order to have a Christian witness, and Will and I went through this with a very honest young gal who raised some questions one morning out here, seems to me that you witness with your presence, that you live there. A black friend told me when he heard I was coming into the District of Columbia, John, by all means, don't try to have an integrated church. Just get some white folks together. And I said, well, I didn't plan to have a segregated church. He said, I know that, but... Well, he said, let me put it as straight as I can. For 200 years, you didn't want to live next door to me. Now, why would I suddenly let you tamper with my soul? Just stay away from the people you haven't wanted to live next door to. And to a certain extent, I think that's what we found. Our breakthrough to the city was that Mark got into a football game on the middle of Newport Place, and this white kid, after about 4 times of running out and nobody paying any attention to him, all the black kids were covered, and there was only this white kid, and the quarterback threw the ball, and Mark caught it. I think it was providence. He was in. No more questions asked. The kid can catch the ball. Let him play. But that was after some time of being there. You live there. You participate in that life. And you witness with your servanthood with no strings attached. Not even that they come to hear your sermons. Not even that they come to faith in your Lord, no matter how much that's your earnest hope. That's not your reason for expending your life for the sake of that community's life or for the sake of people's life. And you witness with your proclamation about that which gives you life. You witness to Him who is your Lord. But for a while, that's tampering with souls until you have some right to share that. We put an ichthus on all of our doors when we moved in. I'll never forget, I went around the corner and said hello to some woman who runs a rooming house, and I said, good morning, and she said, are you new here? And I said, yes, fairly new. She said, you better watch it. There's a very strange thing. It's a group moved in, and they have magic, some kind of magic markers over their door. The grapevine said, I don't know if we were communists or what, but you know, and so I said, oh, I have one of those, and I started talking about the ichthus. And another guy rang the doorbell. Mary answered, and he said, is the party here? He had a whole case of beer. Is the party here? She said, no. What number did you want? We didn't have any number, just an ichthus. He said, I wanted 1315. She said, no, this is 1319. And he said, oh, by the way, what's the fish? And she said, oh, that's an early symbol of... Oh, hell, he said. walked away with the case of beer. But anyway, to be able to witness with your presence and to be able to affirm, to be able to celebrate liturgically and to find ways of participating in the life of that city, I think is very important. I think it's very important racially that there are some white people who live there. Let me give one story and then I'll quit, because it's more about Mary than myself. We have a black law student. Now he's a lawyer. He was a law student up until 3 weeks ago. He graduated from Howard Law School. Came up from South Carolina, black, and he gave a shared word at the community one morning. He said, I want you to know that this community has been very hard on me. He said, I was raised with a tension because my total experience as a boy was to hate Whitey. He has shared with Mark some of the things that happened to him as a boy. The white boys dragged him through sawdust one time till he almost choked to death. They wouldn't let him up, and his face kept going through the sawdust, and he couldn't breathe. But the woman who raised him, not his real mother, but the woman who raised him every night said, Alex, don't hate anybody. It'll just destroy you. Don't hate Whitey. So he said, I had a constant tension between my experience and between my mother, whom I loved. I came to Howard University and the tension was gone, baby. Everything was clear. Hate Whitey. My experience of white policemen in the District of Columbia, my peers, my professors, my black community, everything was hate Whitey, and it was very simple. And you, and he looked at us, you've brought the tension back. Because I get up in the morning and I'm on the way to law school and it's 8 o'clock in the morning and I've got it all clear and Mary Schramm has just come out to take the paper in. They live next door, two doors down. Mary Schramm has come out to take the paper in and she raises that white fist and says, have a good day, Alex, and I can't hate her.
You see, now if I just might respond for a minute, John. There's a difference between servant presence and control. There is a difference in what black people need by definition and what they really need in terms of understanding. Black people welcome the sort of tension that comes that way. Black people, if they need anything at all right now, need that sort of tension. As opposed to the other kind, which is always translated into billy clubs and Gestapo-like tactics of armed stormtroopers. They need that sort of, you know, it's like now I'm reminded of one of my white brothers who lives in the city. He says, "Will, I will not leave, and you can't make me. You can't make me leave, because I won't." perhaps the best illustration of interracial acceptance that I know of is a little old lady who lives right down the street from my office. And I used to meet her every morning going to the office, because there's something like, you know, something magical about at least being able to choose whether you're going to walk or ride. So we have the choice between walking for 1 hour or riding for 7 minutes, unless there's an accident on the freeway, and then it could turn into 2 hours if you're trapped there in between off ramps. Frightened to death when she would meet me. Coming from the grocery store, she would turn her back and stop and hold the groceries to her chest. And finally, after seeing this happen a few times, I just asked, why are you afraid? And she says, you're a Negro, aren't you? And I said, well, yes, I'm a Negro. Well, that's why I'm afraid. I said, but I'm a pastor. She said, oh, I know that, but you're still a Negro. And her fear, to cut the story short, was that I'd probably knock her down, take her groceries, and do something bad to her, you know. Well, we talked. And we talked a lot, and we still talk. You know, she calls me up sometimes, and I'm in the middle of all kinds of things, and she wants to tell me stories about the old country, and I listen to them, and they're perfectly fascinating stories. You know, you'd be surprised at the number of sermons you could develop from some of those stories. Some of them about oppression, and some of them not so much about oppression as about some of her pleasant memories. Sometimes when I go to the office now. Sometimes when I go to the office now, I find Swedish loaves, you know, in the mailbox, and baby food, and all kinds of things. You know, she just stops by sometimes, just fills up the mailbox with these things.
Isn't this precisely what we were talking about, Will?
What?
Isn't this precisely what we've been talking about? It's
but you see, there's what we have been talking about is this invisible shield which is built between people as a result of the perpetuation of the myths about the city versus the other areas.
Well,
what we're talking about is the lost motion involved in the time spent in those little cellophane machines, with emphasis on the cell, as opposed to touching and being touched by people. What we're talking about is the fact that so many people pass over on the freeways and leave their cigarette butts and their empty beer cans, and they're totally oblivious to the fact that there are people living beneath those things, you see. And made, rubbed out by those things. For example, the Bay Area has rather two interesting ways of solving the problem of, quotes, ghetto, close quotes, housing. They run a freeway through it, or they run the rapid transit through it. You see. Now, the decision about where the freeways go, you know, the decision about where the train tracks go, are not made by people who inhabit the city. They're made by people outside.
Incidentally, by the same token, where freeways go and where these things travel throughout the outer community through the country is not made by the people who inhabit those areas, but by someone other than them.
Let me tell you, those people have fantastic control. We've got the award-winning freeway in the United States. It's supposed to be the best thing that ever happened. It's called the MacArthur Freeway. Some of you've heard of it. It's a beautiful thing to ride on, you know. I mean, you almost get the feeling that it's not a freeway. It's sort of like a parkway or something, you know. But it's high, But it's got all of the comforts, you know, very pleasing to the eye, beautiful ivy hangings. You know, it's really a magnificent thing. No trucks are allowed. That freeway goes through a section of the Piedmont Hills, and you let a trucker get onto that thing, you know? You let any kind of diesel engine get onto that thing. You let the neighborhood hear the sound of a truck breaking down to go around a curve or to go off of a hill. You see? They control that thing because it was built for them. Six lanes on either side, escape route from the city. So they do have something to say about it.
Yeah, but the farm community, by the same token, has little to say where this freeway is going through the land. When government decides that we're going to put a freeway through your place, even though it might separate it, that's where it goes. Now, I know we're supposed to be government, but sometimes we have very little say, no matter what community we might happen to be in, whether it be the city or the country, as it were. Incidentally, one thing that I'd like to ask, well, and I'll preface this by the fact that I was reading I believe it's the book of Matthew, where Christ says, "Let the little children come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of God. And unless we come to him as little children, not physically, but with the attitude of a child, we can't enter therein." And so, isn't it true that children have to be taught to distrust, taught to hate? Isn't this where the barrier is raised up, this barrier that has existed for 200 years, as I heard it used a while ago? Because it's these kids are being taught, don't trust a black man because he's going to do bad things to you. Or on the other hand, hate whitey. I mean, they're the same thing, but we're being taught to hate, constantly taught to hate by our parents, by government, and so on. We are now being taught to hate in many respects by the news media because of what they're publishing.
Well, you know, I have no argument with that, except that the hate whitey thing, you have to understand, is, in my own estimation, a legitimate response to oppression. And you have to understand that. You have to understand the emotional content of that statement. You know, why? It's like understanding why revolts happen in the city, as opposed to moralizing about the rightness or wrongness of revolts. You know, let's get in behind them and see what it is that makes it happen. Gregory has the analogy of the shoe being too tight and a corn growing on it. And if it's not given attention, then it becomes calloused, and finally it'll come right through the top of the shoe. You see, it has something to say about going against the natural forces that make a man move and gives him some sense of dignity and worth. If his emotions and if his person is pressed against the wall to that extent, then he becomes indiscriminate in his violence as well as indiscriminate in his rhetoric.
Yeah.
Now let me just say a word about how children are taught to hate. This opens up almost another evening. One that we at least touched on a little bit when we were in the education session. Even though parents might be liberal and Christian and loving and all of that, and they may spend an awful lot of time teaching their children to love, yet there's a rather vicious thing that they are caught in, and just one of those things is the history books. You see, it takes an awful lot of undoing once you've used this funnel that we call education to dupe people into the acceptance of certain stereotypes about people. I'll just give you one example. No matter how loving and liberal and understanding a given teacher is, she just isn't aware of what happens when the play on words happen when it talks about Indians and white people. You know, now this is the one that just comes to mind immediately. We've discussed before the difference between a battle and a massacre, for example. You know, Custer was massacred by Sitting Bull. If the same thing had happened the other way around, and Custer had won, then Custer would not have massacred Sitting Bull. Custer would have won a battle, right?
Yeah, and they call it the Battle of Wounded Knee.
Yes.
Remember that one?
Yes.
Where the men who had been comrades of Custer's men later on killed women and children running away from the battle, 2 miles
exactly.
Farther away,
right.
Killed by these
right, the Wounded Knee thing, that's right.
But that was a battle.
Yes, that was a battle. Now, pick up your history books. You have children? Pick up the books that they're reading and read through them and see what you get.
So I recognize
programmatic, systemic racism.
Yeah, I recognize this.
And I say, if you want to do something, give the children a chance. You know, give the children a chance. Cultural deprivation is not a thing which is to be directed at blacks and poor people and red people, etc. But it's to be directed at white people at this point, those who have accepted all of the myths, Washington crossing the Delaware and throwing a silver dollar across it, you know, the Potomac or whatever it was, you know, and all of the grandiose things about white people, and the complete neglecting of, you know, the issue of black history. We always argue, you know, at black students' unions in the Bay Area, you know, we're not talking really about black history. We're talking about truthful American history. You know, we're talking about the truth of a country that was born out of the situations which are described in confrontations between reds and whites and further developed over the backs of blacks and browns and yellows. And it is still happening now. You see, that's the truth.
Yeah, I recognize this. And what I was saying a while ago is that an infant doesn't hate in and of himself. He has to be taught to hate through society or through his relationship with his parents, although I find that most children think their parents don't know anything. It's only their teachers and the books that they read that are really right in a general sense. But we have to be taught to hate. I agree wholeheartedly. The black has a justifiable reason to hate whitey because of what's been perpetrated on them through the years. I buy that part of it. But it doesn't change the fact that they are being taught to hate by virtue of this and by virtue of an attitude that exists there.
I beg to differ with you. Blacks are not being taught to hate whitey.
All right. I'll buy this then. And I will accept this. Another question I'd like to ask, and then I'm going to quit. What is, in general, in the blacks that you come in contact with, what is the general attitude of the black toward himself as a black man?
Let me just speak to the first question first, okay? For those of you who question whether or not blacks are being taught to hate whitey, please read, if you can, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And I'll repeat again, there's a difference between reading about Eldridge Cleaver and reading Eldridge Cleaver. And you'll see that the most paranoid, vicious, violent black in the country quotes from the scriptures. And he is tough when he starts talking about Babylon, but he is just as tough when he starts to speak to his brothers. The price of hating is loving oneself less. Eldridge Cleaver, Soul on Ice.
It's in the library, too, and the bookstore.
Well, that's just one example. I could give you others.
You should have seen the promotion in our local newspaper about his
yeah.
It went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Now,
Soul on Ice.
Yes, Eldridge Cleaver, Rampart. Rampart Books. It's paperback now. I've got to get to his question. Now, just go through your question again. You're in it with blacks. What do they think of
what is the black, what is the black man's shoes. Attitude toward himself as a black man?
Yes.
Now, how does he see himself?
Yes.
Let me go one step further with this question. Does he still see himself as a slave, for example? Does he see himself as he has been brainwashed by the white community largely to think in terms of himself as being something less than a human being, or is the black, well, you answered from that point.
Yeah. I think that the basic bane of Western religion is that initially it did teach black people to love white people but to hate themselves. That happened a number of ways. So blacks were generally not in love with themselves, but they hated themselves because they were black. And most blacks felt as if they were cursed. They accepted almost word for word the old
curse of Ham,
Hamitic theory. Most black people, when they looked in the mirror, probably felt as if they should cut their throats. You know, but the prevailing thing was a rather unique love for life, which prohibited that. That's why, you know, suicides among blacks is practically nil until recently. We've had a few. Gregory also has an answer for that one when he says, prior to the company type blacks, you know, the renter blacks, Negroes, it was a physical and mental impossibility for a man to kill himself by jumping up out of a basement. So the higher one goes, the more susceptible he is to doing himself in, and the more he falls out of love with himself. Blacks believe that blackness is beautiful. They accept the gift of the creation and the gift of redemption. Christian blacks are able to give assent to the presence of a God in Christ, in their context. And that context is, of course, blackness. And they love it. It's beautiful. And hair in its happy state is just, you know, one of the results of that. The fact that that we can wear unashamedly and bear not so mute testimony to the order of creation. At least as it relates itself to the birds and other animals like lions and stuff, you know. This is called not a dashiki, this is a buba. It's longer than a dashiki and it's not made in America. It's from Africa. We have succeeded, I believe, in marrying the two cultures, recognizing that there's really nothing wrong with either one of them. And a brand new culture has emerged, and it's a free one. It's a free culture. The black condition is, without a doubt, the most unhung-up culture condition in the world today. Especially the Afro-American one, which we discovered, at least when we enter into dialogue with our African brethren, who used to always say, why don't y'all come home? And then when we got over there, rejected us because they discovered that we were watered down copies of Western man again, because we went through all these cultural shocks, like, you know, we couldn't eat the food, et cetera, et cetera. Still can't, for that matter. That's why we ain't going back to Africa. But the 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 instrument by which we measure our love for all people, and this is one of the beautiful things about that freedom, is our love for ourselves and our understanding of Christ's mandate: love your neighbor as you love yourself. And we figure that it's always, you know, rather groovy for me to answer that question, but it still does not solve your problem, you see. My freedom sort of traps you if you let it. And more often than not, it does.
Will?
Yes?
I'd like to ask you a question about a reference you made to your day community and your night community.
Yes.
I assume that these people in the day community are those who go to work and try to make a living like an ordinary way with their family and so forth.
Yes, yes.
How do these people feel? And your night community would be the troublesome group of people. Is this the issue yourself?
No.
Well, just have the midnight shift.
Oh, you just mean that this is a night shift and a day shift?
Oh, no, I mean night people.
Your night community?
I really mean night people. Let me describe some of them to you. Pimps, hustlers, prostitutes.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lesbians,
how do you
homosexuals,
yeah.
Blacks,
okay, then that's your night
whites,
community.
Reds, brown.
Okay. What do your day community people, and how do they survive within this community of that kind of people?
Oh, the topless dancers don't have much problem. A lot of uptight, middle-class, gray flannel suit guys sneak in to the city when their wives don't know it. And some of them stay over and work late. And, I'm not making fun of it. I'm answering your question. They stay over and they work late, you know. So some of the people who yell about vice in the city the most are the people who hang around the Tenderloin district. For example, it's a very interesting thing about prostitution. We average, I think in San Francisco, something like 15, 20 prostitutes per block on a good evening. All of them are black, maybe with the exception of one or two. Now, when the sailors come in on ships like the Enterprise, you know, now that's a lot of men. And most all of them are white. Blacks still don't care too much for water. but the interesting thing is that the sailors will pass up the white girl to get to a black girl. And prior to the change in the complexion in the Fillmore, they would pass up 20 white girls to get to the one black girl standing at the end of the corner. There's something magical about attaining the unattainable, I suppose. And this is, you know, of course, now some folks say, well, you're talking about the sordid stuff, but this is the way, for example, the prostitutes live. You know, they tax the suburbanites. And it's good money for 1 hour, and quite often it's not an hour.
What I'm asking you is this: do your day people not segregate themselves
yes.
from the night people?
Yes, yes. They are different from the night people. The night people are the people whom Franz Fanon describes as the wretched of the earth. You know. They are the despised and rejected ones for so-called good reasons. Sort of like the people Jesus hung out with. You know, when he was walking the streets of his cities.
So in other words, these day people have little concern for their nice people? Is this what happens after segregating?
I doubt very seriously whether many of the day people even know that the night people are there. It's one of the...
Is it a racial question? I don't understand. Do the...
I'm trying to figure out, basically, because I feel so many times that blame is being placed, and I don't know whether this is right or wrong, but in facing a problem, it seems to me that, logically, families trying to raise families who want to segregate themselves from this kind of community, and Will says that they don't know, basically, that it exists. So, my question is, do they... this daytime community in themselves do anything to help the problem of the night people or the wretchedness that you're talking about?
Yeah, they try to pass laws to help the people. But
do you consider it a problem?
We all know what kind of... Do I consider what a problem?
The nightlife?
No. That's where I find authentic humanity. People are less liable to shuck and jive me out there on the streets at night. You know, what I mean is that, you know, of course, now I have toyed with the idea of getting at the people who are leaving the city when they're at a weak moment, and that's by setting up confessional booths, you know, at the tollway gates, as they get mad with the guy in front of them, and that you can read lips. And some of the words that come out of these anti-pornography, anti-dirty speech characters, it's frightening. But that's only when somebody stops short in front of them, or when the air conditioning breaks.
I'm still not sure. Sometimes
I'm trying to straighten out in my own thinking, who's who?
Yeah, all right. Sometimes there's a criticism of the black middle-class person who's gotten out of the ghetto that he doesn't then care any more about the people who are still in. That would be one thing. No more or less than the white immigrant who got out of that ghetto and made it, does he still, you know, does he devote all his time? In fact, I think right now black people more than whites probably continue to work for all of their people, but to expect something that we never did is unrealistic. The night people in New York City certainly are not all black, and do the white people who work downtown and go out on the commuter to Long Island have a concern for the night people who come out after they leave? You know, I think you just have to take it across the board about us.
That's what and, I'm trying to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, okay.
We're trying to get straight in my own head what really does go on.
It was interesting that in the
April
disturbance that was called the April Riot after Martin Luther King in Washington, D.C. I guess it's important which you call it. There was only one white person killed. The people who were killed in that were mostly black kids, but there was one white person killed. If you'd lived in D.C. and had heard that it was a white man who was a member of the electrical union, and he was killed at the corner of 14th and U, could almost for certain assume that he was there for a black woman. That three union members white at 14th and U late at night. The chances that it was anything else. Now, if he yelled MF to some kids who were around his car, and that's the most closed union anyway, racially in D.C. So that it's. The business of the white community supporting and wanting the nightlife in D.C., the last judge that tried to handle that was he put a fairly nice-looking female policeman on the corner, and she doesn't really solicit, but it's possible to mistake her, and then the suburbanite gets fined. And the last one, he fined exactly what it would cost for a rehabilitation program for a prostitute. Just transferred it directly and let the suburbanite pay for some kind of therapy for a prostitute downtown. But I'm not sure we clarified. But
See, this is a part of it. We've got sort of the same thing going for us in San Francisco, except that the same problem in Oakland, you know, except that they've licked it now. They were arresting both the prostitute and her, the guy who accompanied her, the one who was buying from her, you know, And it's terribly embarrassing, you know. Guess what, honey? You know, called from a San Francisco jail, you know, out to Walnut Creek or someplace.
Paul is gone. One of the things that I didn't get to say, Will, and I know it's very late, we ought to just, you know, some people may be staying out of some kind of courtesy that really isn't necessary to me at 11 o'clock. One of the things
they stay up all night.
All right. One of the things that I wanted to say, for me to say that the church can celebrate the city does not mean that the church never speaks out in some prophetic way and says, that's sick or that's sinful. Yeah, I celebrate the city does not mean that to me. There was in a Lutheran magazine that somebody was very tired of inner city pastors placing the mantle of respectability over the works of the devil in the inner city. And I think that's possible. And I think that's a valid statement to somebody who's working in the city who tends to condone or excuse, because it's their people, anything they do. If you could, in the same breath, say, and the potential for a suburban or a small town, white clergyman of the Lutheran Church to place the mantle of respectability over the works of the devil among his people, fine. You know, but that wasn't added. But I think celebrate the city, if it means you never say that's simply not the way it is in God's kingdom, I think that would be a mistake.
These people that are have fantastic insight. The night people, they don't just see in the dark. They, you know, they see some other things. For example, one girl who works at a bar, she's a waitress at a bar in San Francisco, says that she can always tell when the Roman priests come to town, even though they're dressed in civilian clothes, because she watches the shoes and the socks and the pants, and they almost always forget to take off the bottom half of their clerical garb. And she speaks to them, "Hi, Father, how are you?" And, "Oh!" You know, for a moment there, I guess there's a state of oblivion from both ends of the spectrum. But by the same token, these men, you know, once they're recognized, become, you know, really great people to dialogue with. For example, there's a lady who's now middle class, who was a stripper in the daytime and a prostitute at night. And she, being middle class and having sent two girls through a fashionable New England finishing school, her two daughters, through a real, real nice school, recognized that her appeal was going, and she could neither make money stripping or prostituting. And so she decided to kill herself, and to at least allow the last little baby that she had the luxury of making it through life with her insurance money. And she had rather large insurance. Well, Don Stewart, young white night minister, who walks the street in a much better way than some of the black ministers, because he's got a little beep beep thing on his side. You know, I mean, he's harnessed all of the magic of electronics. You know, he's got a telephone answering system with five or six people working for him, suicide prevention and everything plugs into it. And he got this beep beep one night that somebody was locked up in an apartment room and obviously was contemplating suicide or was terribly broken up, because the neighbors in the house could hear the sobs from the room. Well, he went up and he sat and talked with her all night. The final question that she asked him was, "What church would accept me?" And Don said, "I know of one." So it is not a matter, you know, of the minister condoning You know, and you're right, John, and I think it's important that we point this up. Or defending all of the sinful activities that go on. It's a matter of understanding. It's a matter of listening. It's a matter of not always jumping to the moral question. And it seems to me that that was the style of Jesus. Talked a long time with that woman at the well about water before he got her so excited about it that she ran back into town and invited all of the sinful people who had been hanging out with her to come and experience this.